Welcome to episode 56 of the Accessibility Craft Podcast, where we explore the art of creating accessible websites while trying out interesting craft beverages. This podcast is brought to you by the team at Equalize Digital, a WordPress accessibility company and the proud creators of the Accessibility Checker plugin. In this episode, we review the changes introduced with Web Content Accessibility Guidelines version 2.2 in detail, and talk about key areas where organizations will need to implement changes in order to adapt to the new standards. For show notes and a full transcript, go to accessibilitycraft.com/056. And now, on to the show.
Hey everybody, it's Amber, and I am here with Chris.
Hello everyone.
And Steve.
Hello.
And we are going to do sort of a delayed conversation about Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.2, which were released in October. But there is some interesting things that are changes, and I know a lot of organizations haven't rolled that out yet, so we thought it might be good to talk about WCAG 2.2.
Yeah, I'm excited to run through it because I know that I was just saying before we started recording that I've read through that summary about three times, and I'm still trying to retain everything because some of the changes are definitely a little bit complex. But we're gonna talk through them in order. And I think before that we have a interesting beverage slash puzzle that I'm excited to introduce.
Yeah. So what are we drinking, Chris? What is
so
this?
We've got Ramune, which is comes in different flavors, but it is a Japanese soda that has been around since the 1800s. It used to just be like carbonated lemonade, but since then it's come into all sorts of different flavors. And the unique thing about it for people who haven't seen it before, and you can kind of see it captured on the screen here, is there is a in the neck of the bottle, there is a narrower portion. And then the bottle is actually sealed with a glass marble instead of a twist top. And so to open this, you have to use the included little tool piece in the top of the bottle to basically push down really hard and knock the glass marble down into the receptacle so that you can drink it. And it should maybe produce some interesting background noise as we open these up. But other than that, it's a soda. It's going to be sweet. It's going to taste, you know, like whatever flavor they assign to it. But I'm going to go ahead and punch mine down here. We'll see if we can get it on mic.
Oh yeah.
Wait a minute. I want to know, like, it's the 1800s, really? Oh, there's instructions. Where are the instructions? It's on the
tab here on the very top.
Oh yeah, so it has a plastic lid over the glass bottle and a wrapper. Mm-hmm. I have to peel. I haven't
eaten. And then you have to separate this piece from the housing, which is something I forgot because I definitely don't drink these all the time.
Remove the seal from the top, detach the plunger.
That was loud.
Yeah. Place the plunger on top of the bottle, press down firmly with the base of your palm to release the marble. Throw away the seal cap and plunger and have fun drinking Ramune. That's what you said. Yeah.
And I don't know if I can really get this on camera, but you can kind of see the glass marble in there with the bubbles on it in a little glass receptacle. But it's kind of fun. It's different.
Let's go for the ASMR. Ready?
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys, I'm going to try and push down on this and I probably won't be able to. I'm a little bit afraid.
Did you get it? Oh man, it's spilling.
No, I can't. Okay, hold on. You really have to push hard on this.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Wait, I have to.
Yeah, with the palm of your hand,
up.
And then brace the bottom so it doesn't slide on you.
There you
go. Can't
do
it.
She can't.
Did you separate? Did you separate the two lid pieces?
Wait, what do you mean separate the two lid pieces?
Like so this. if you look at our camera, like these two things separate. So you got to kind of push down.
Oh wait. The thing I'm supposed to be pushing down was still in the wrapper I removed. So yeah. I was just pushing down on a blue plastic thing that does nothing.
Yep.
No wonder it was very hard. Okay, trying again.
And don't push that yet, Amber. You got to separate the two pieces of the lid. So this little plastic piece breaks away.
You told me on Twitter that you were going to do this and I was going to look dumb. And now here I am looking
that's,
dumb.
And you made fun of me.
But look,
okay, fine.
You're like,
all
don't
right,
give it away.
Look what it did to my hand.
What did it do?
I've got
what
circles
it did to
on
your
my hand. Yeah. I've got indentations on the palm of my hand.
Okay, wait.
The palm of my hand.
I don't understand these instructions.
The palm of my hand has a perfect round circle imprinted on it, and it's a little red.
Okay, so now that I've separated them, then I push down just on the tiny piece?
Yep, and it should punch down in.
There. Ooh, she did it.
I got it, finally. Okay, that was a puzzle and very challenged. Also, I am almost certain that Alex Stein would tell us that this is not an accessible bottle.
No, not at all.
I mean, you
very much not.
You need someone to teach you how to open them. But once you know how, it probably is accessible. It's just knowing how.
It like releases the marble down into the from the top into the bottom there. I wonder how many people have swallowed this marble or if it's ever made its way back out.
Well, it did say somewhere on there not to eat it.
Yeah. Do not eat the glass marble. Yes.
I'm wondering, why does the marble only go like partway into the neck? Like, why did they make the bottle that way? Just to make it look interesting? Or do you think it does something versus the marble going all the way to the bottom of the bottle?
It's more visual, right?
Maybe that. Maybe if the marble plunges all the way down to the bottom, it
would shatter into glass
with the carbonation or something. Maybe it does something with the carbonation. You know, like how like sometimes if you like slap the top of a beer bottle, it can all turn to foam.
Yeah.
I wonder if the act of the marble like shooting down to the all the way to the bottom would do something to the soda.
Oh, and, make it fizz foam over. Up more.
Breaks the bottom of the glass.
Yeah.
Well, is it also like? I wonder if. No, I guess it's not totally sealing in between the neck. It can go around it.
So did we announce what flavors we're drinking?
No.
No. So I'm trying melon, which is very melony.
And green.
And green. Green. Right. Yeah.
And I'm, what are you drinking, Steve? You're red.
I'm red. I'm drinking the strawberry.
All right. So I decided, well, you guys know how I feel about food coloring, but I decided I would go for original, which is white. And I have no idea. I'm about to find out.
That should be like a lemon lime flavor.
It's clear. It's clear. It's not white.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. It is clear.
Yeah. The thing that's fun about this is it's like you get a little extra noise with your drink.
Drink out of.
Like Steve mentioned ASMR, you kind of have this.
Oh, the marble rolling around in there?
Jiggling around while you drink.
This is lemon lime? I don't think this is lemon lime.
That's what the original flavor was, but maybe their original was something else.
Yeah, it's hard to drink because the glass is like made out of like two sections. There's like an upper section and a bottom section, and you know the bottom has to fill the top before you can get any.
Maybe it is lemon lime, but it's a weird. It's not like Sprite or 7-Up or something. Like, I don't know what kind of lemon. Like maybe there's a little bit of citrus in there, but I don't know.
It's not like as sugary as I thought it would be. It's more like a, like a red cream soda. Mine is the strawberry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the first thing I noticed too. Having the melon is it's not super sweet, which tracks. Like if you have Japanese desserts, they're usually not super sugary. But that's going to be our beverage to pair with WCAG 2.2. Amber, do you want to get us started?
Yeah, so there are different versions of web content accessibility guidelines, and the one that we have lived with and worked off of for 5+ years, probably, I can't remember the exact date, was WCAG 2.1. And in October, after much delay, especially due to COVID, 2.2 came out. And it had a few changes that I thought would be sort of interesting for us to talk through, both what's new, and they removed a guideline. And maybe that's sort of an interesting place to start.
Yeah.
Anyone remember what they removed?
It has to do with having proper closing tags and right? Like,
so what used to be was success criterion 4.1.1 parsing. And it had more. Yeah, I think it had to do with like having proper semantic tags, but also like naming. And what I was reading when they removed that was they said that anything that failed 4.1.1 also would by default fail info and relationships and name role value. And so they ended up deciding that they didn't need that because it was duplicative and wasn't really unique enough. So they just removed 4.1.1.
So that was in content implemented using markup languages. Elements have complete start and end tags. Elements are nested according to their specification. Elements do not contain duplicate attributes, and any IDs are unique, except where the specifications allow these features.
So what I'm reading here is that apparently assistive tech has increasingly started to rely on browsers to handle the parsing and the parsing errors and to interpret the code. And so since that change, because I didn't know this, but apparently like screen readers and stuff used to do it, their own markup parsing, and the browsers didn't, which I thought was interesting. A little bit of history that I didn't know. But
I mean, screen readers are like 30 years old, right? Like JAWS.
I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. But basically, it's like the technology has advanced sufficiently that this is no longer required. And like you were saying, it's there's other rules that basically cover this. Yeah, or supersede it.
So it doesn't mean that, it doesn't necessarily mean to go out there and stop adding close tags, right? And yeah. adding duplicate IDs, right? Like it still applies, right?
Yeah, it's just if you come across that, like duplicate, I don't know if I've seen many things where a developer is left without a close tag. If that is, it's an accident. Usually you'd notice it because other things are messed up on the page. Like a link without an end closing tag would result in all the text following it having the link styles and functionality, right?
Well, I mean, I've seen the browser like interpret those before. Like, I don't know necessarily.
And fix it?
Yeah, close it. Like I've seen in a few cases where it's like auto interpreted the tag. Like it's fixed it even when it shouldn't have been fixed, right? It should have been an error, but like I look at the source, I'm like, wait, hold on, this looks right, but the code doesn't look right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, I think though that they were saying, like, even if you came across that, you could fail it for another reason. So
there's a new spec, there's a new thing to refer to when you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about what they added. And maybe we can just sort of go down this list for people who haven't had a chance to review it yet. So the first one was it's 2.4.11. Focus not obscured minimum. This is a double A requirement. And basically this is saying, so we had before focus visible, meaning that when you tab through the page with your keyboard, you always have to see a visible focus indicator, which is normally an outline. And this is now saying that other things cannot get in the way of that, or like partially cover it, or cover it completely. Like if they had an example of if there are banners on the page and the focus goes behind it, which to me, it's so interesting that they had to create this, because when I think of focus visible, I'm like, not only like it also shouldn't be obscured, but I don't know if you guys have thoughts on why.
My immediate reaction when I read this, and I remember because I brought it up with you, Amber, and you were like, wait to talk about this on the podcast. So now I'm going to talk about this, which is, believe it or not, I don't have every WCAG criteria memorized. And so when I was reading this, I was like, I immediately asked Amber, I was like, this wasn't a requirement before to have visible focus. You know, that was my immediate question. But no, it's like clarifying that you have to, like, the focus also can't be covered in addition to having to be visible. But so maybe that clarification is necessary. Maybe someone was trying to be technically correct instead of correct, and just say, well, the focus is still there. It's just covered. So they had to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in like user testing it, like the reason why we're probably like, oh, that wasn't required, because like when we user test, we would, I mean, you guys
do that anyway.
It just seemed like made sense. Right. But I can see the challenge from a development standpoint. Right. Like, In our own plugin, the accessibility checker, when we got a front end highlighting feature, right? When you highlight certain elements, and we have to do a lot with focus state in regard to that, And we're highlighting elements that don't exist on the page, or they're like off to the side of the page or above, right? Like they're out of the viewport. So we had to like account for that. We had to like move them into the viewport and then show them. Now where that can get kind of weird is that say it's on a website that has like, a pop-up, right? Or right? Like it's so from a development standpoint, we probably if there's some way for us to evaluate if something's overlaying that, and that can get very difficult. If things are being injected through JavaScript, and then you got to think too, like it's responsive too. It's at any size, and anything that like overlays content gets kind of difficult when it gets squeezed down to mobile because you're covering up most of the page anyway, right? So.
Yeah, well, and so then the other one, which is sort of related to this, is the AAA version. So 2.4.12, focus not obscured, enhanced. So the other one says it needs to be at least partially visible, but it could potentially, right? Like on the right side, it's cut off, or on the left side, it's cut off. We've seen that sometimes because we do outline offsets. And I don't know what you guys do to fix it, but a lot of times when I'm doing like a very first round of tests, if I tab through stuff like a grid of posts or something, like all the ones in the middle will be fine, but like the ones on the left, like the outline offset will be like, I don't know, outside of the container div. And so it's hidden. I don't know.
It has to do with some Gutenberg blocks that have overflow hidden on them. So,
So you just have to say overflow visible and then it's fine.
I mean, if the block that we're using gives us the option to do that, we can do it in an editor. If not, I've done it with a class, just add a class to the block so it shows, but.
So it sounds like in this first instance, the double A, it'd be fine if the focus was cut off on just one side. And the triple A is that it's visible everywhere, like fully visible without anything blocking like one part of it or partial.
I mean, it gets a little difficult. We try to do like a 2 pixel outline with a 2 pixel outline offset on most elements. So you're looking at 4 pixels all the way around that you have to account for. So yeah, you could make sure you don't have a your overflow hidden, or you can, have a little bit of extra padding there to account for those outlines.
You want to share the next one, Chris?
Yeah, so in terms of, so we would be looking at 2.4.13 focus appearance, or do you want to jump to 2.5?
No, let's talk about focus appearance. We haven't talked about that one yet. I mean, that
So,
kind of tails off of what Steve just said, like what's been our practice for years. So what does that literally say?
So what it literally says is when a keyboard focus indicator is visible, an area of the focus indicator meets all of the following. It's at least as large as the area of a 2 CSS pixel thick perimeter, and has a contrast ratio of at least 3 to 1. The exceptions would be if the focus indicator is determined by the user agent and cannot be adjusted by the author, or the focus indicator and the indicator's background color are not modified by the author. So there are some exception cases in there, but generally 2 pixels, 3 to 1 contrast ratio, focus indicator.
This episode of Accessibility Craft is sponsored by Equalize Digital Accessibility Checker, the WordPress plugin that helps you find accessibility problems before you hit publish. A WordPress native tool, Accessibility Checker provides reports directly on the post edit screen. Reports are comprehensive enough for an accessibility professional or developer, but easy enough for a content creator to understand. Accessibility Checker is an ideal tool to audit existing WordPress websites, find accessibility problems during new builds, or monitor accessibility and remind content creators of accessibility best practices on an ongoing basis. Scans run on your server, so there are no per-page fees or external API connections. GDPR and privacy compliant, real-time accessibility scanning. Scan unlimited posts and pages with Accessibility Checker free. Upgrade to a paid version of Accessibility Checker to scan custom post types and password-protected sites. View site-wide open issue reports and more.
Download Accessibility Checker free today at equalizedigital.com/accessibility-checker. Use coupon code accessibilitycraft to save 10% on any paid plan.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
That's typically what we do, right? Except for we add an offset, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and don't we also have like a double color outline so that whether it's light mode or dark mode,
or we don't? That's really hard to do. I mean, on buttons, it's easy, but if you have links that wrap, haven't we tried doing that with a border and like a shadow or something, or an outline offset, or I don't know what it's called.
Yeah.
Outline offset.
What happens is that if you don't define outline, the browser would try to interpret it and the browser will add both.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you see the default blue and the white around everything.
Like in Chrome, it's blue and white.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In any Chromium browser, you'll see that, but we typically will go through and add our own outline. So it is more difficult to do that. Like you can do it with like a, like a box shadow and an outline, but it gets kind of messy. Right. So what we typically try to do is we try to evaluate the focus state on a section by section basis.
Yeah. Right. And if possible, we try not to set the color and allow the browser to do it. So they do get a two color, and then we'll only go back and like set color if we have to, because it just really doesn't pass contrast.
Yeah.
But so this one, they added this and it's AAA, and it really bugs me that it's AAA. And I probably at some point I'm going to go back and try and dig through, because all the conversations on these are open because it's an open source project, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. Because I don't love that this is AAA. And it's so interesting to me that this got added. I mean, I wish that they would have enhanced focus visible AA, because literally what it says is like people should be able to see the focus indicator. So yeah. It can't be tiny. And I got my first, I'm going to get my WordPress core contributor badge. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Not because I committed any code, but because I opened an issue that led towards Joe Dolson committing code for me.
Hey, a badge is a badge, right?
Yeah, but it was because there was a focus state in the 2024 theme that I discovered when I was building our shop with it on buttons that was a one pixel dotted. And so it was very thin, it was dotted, and it was interesting because I opened the issue and I was like, this should be 2 pixels and it should be solid always. Like, this should just be our standard. And then someone came back and they were all like, well, that's WCAG 2.2 and we don't meet that. And I was like, no, this is the best practice way before WCAG 2.2 said you should do this. They just did, right? Like, I was like, we should just do it. And it does kind of bug me that they made it AAA, because I'm concerned that, you know, I don't know, clients or web developers who feel like they have to meet, but they don't really want to, are going to look at that and be like, oh no, a one pixel border is fine, because that's AAA and we're not meeting AAA. We're just meeting AA. I don't know if you guys thought about that, but like sometimes I feel like the guidelines can hurt you because people feel like they're the bare, like they want to do the bare minimum.
Yeah, I mean, there's always those. I mean, there's always the technical people too, and then there's always the people on the internet that want to have an argument, right? It's like, or they want to win an argument.
And, yeah.
But I mean, I think we've always, right? We've always practiced like, what's the best thing to do, right? It's like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're not saying you have to meet AAA on everything, but this one is super easy. Let's just do the right thing.
And it can make a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would have been interested to be a fly on the wall. I mean, that might all be public discussion, but like what pushed them to make it AAA instead of AA?
Yeah, I would be curious to know that. I don't know. If we'd been smart, I would have asked somebody before this podcast so I could report, we could report on that, but that might be as a good follow-up item for us to see if we can find the discussion for that. And if so, link it in the show notes. So. Mm-hmm. So Those are three new guidelines around focus indicators, which I think are all good, but maybe I sort of question the level on them. And then we move into guidelines about input modalities, which for those of us who are not technical, what the heck does that even mean? Input modalities.
Modalities. I just like saying that word. Modalities. Sounds like an 80s pop band or something, right? The modalities.
Input modalities.
Input modalities.
This is what Steve's going to name his band.
It immediately makes me think of modals, but I think I'm guessing it's beyond that.
It just has to do with how you can input information. I think is what this means, right? So what's up first there?
So this is 2.5.7 dragging movements. All functionality that uses a dragging movement for operation can be achieved by a single pointer without dragging, unless dragging is essential or the functionality is determined by the user agent and not modified by the author.
So user agent references like browser or like phone, right?
Yeah.
So I think this most applies to, like, I've seen this sometimes on forums where they're like, rank order things that are most to least important to you, and people drag and drop things into order. And this is basically saying, right, you have to have a way for people to do this without dragging and dropping with their mouse.
Yeah. That benefits that benefits those that can use a mouse over those that can't, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we want to equalize the playing field here for everybody and provide an alternative for keyboard users, right? That's what I'm getting out of it.
Yep. And this is a double A. So it is something that people are going to have to do. It's not like a triple A bonus, right? So I the thing that I think is interesting, because at first you're like, oh, we don't really see that much in WordPress. But I will say, beyond the form plugins, that some of them have field options for that.
The menu.
Yeah. Within WordPress itself, the WordPress editor and the blocks, being able to drag and drop them. Or I've noticed this.
But there is an alternative on the blocks.
What's the alternative on blocks? Use a classic editor plugin?
No, there's up and down arrows that you can move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying. So they've done that there, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but also, I think if you're a plugin developer and you're building things for the block editor and you're hooking into those default stuff, then that will already be done for you because people on the Gutenberg team have put effort into that. Now, where I see this failing is people that use, they create custom blocks, either custom React blocks or blocks that are, I don't know if I've noticed this in ACF. I'm not sure if that exists in ACF, but
repeater fields can be drag and drop.
Oh yeah, repeater fields or
and I don't think there's an alternative.
What is the, I don't know why I'm forgetting, but there's flexible
content.
Well, outside of ACF, there's a competitor to ACF. I can't remember. But in the sidebar, I've seen this where there's settings in the sidebar for controlling the block settings in the editor that require drag and drop to like order things. Mm. And I've seen those quite a bit where they're not, they can't be.
I've also seen like drag drops for like defining image size and stuff, but usually there's a text input alternative for those. The other thing that jumped to mind for this with me is with our company's bank, there's a web interface that you can use to remotely deposit. And the action of depositing requires you to click and drag a dollar sign from one end of a bar to another.
Wait, for real?
And I'm wondering if, and that's the only way to submit that I know of. I mean, maybe if I started tabbing, it would give me an alternative, but I'm guessing that would, things like that would be a violation, right? Things that require any sort of this type of motion. That's something that jumped to mind to me.
Think you just figured out how we're going to make our $2 million. You're going to, next time you want to transfer money between our bank accounts, you're going to attempt to do it with your keyboard alone. And then when you can't, you're going to sue them. And our bank is going to give us lots of money and probably tell us we can't be customers anymore.
Oh my gosh. This is what's wrong. This is what's wrong with the American accessibility culture.
Yeah.
I mean, is it though? I can't believe that's the only way.
Speaking of, I can't believe that's the only way. It's like that's the problem. I'm not saying that the idea of suing someone is a problem. That's the only recourse right now. So of course that's what you do. Not that to get a philosophical discussion, but you
can contact them first.
Yes. But no, what I'm saying is there's no, like, for most public, corporations, there's no like regulatory body that's going to go fine them.
Right? I mean, banking has extra rules beyond.
I wonder if what you're talking about is one of the, like, is that a cognitive test?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a mobility test, right? Well, so here's what's so interesting about drag and drop things. They can impact so many people. So people who can't use a mouse are blind people because they can't see where they're pointing it. But also people, like some older people sometimes, or people with tremors like Parkinson's maybe, might have a really hard time like pointing or moving in a certain area and holding the button down while they do it to drag. They can see, they know what they need to do, but their hand might not cooperate. Or people who can't, use their hands or their arms at all. And then, you're like the cognitive, like, so I didn't know our bank, I don't do anything with our money. It's there. It makes me happy. And that's it.
She spends it.
I had no idea. He's dragging and dropping the money into a bank account in the Caymans, and I don't have access to it. I don't know.
We're going to have a talk after this podcast.
But it's interesting. Like, are there instructions? Like, when you first load the page, is it like, in order to process your payment, drag the dollar sign over? Like, does it have written instructions, or do you just have to look at it and know?
I don't know because as a lucky individual, I don't have to read those instructions or figure out an alternate way to do it.
So you haven't paid attention?
I haven't paid attention.
I will say that as a sighted user using drag and drop for years, I feel like there's always a little hack that I have to learn to get a drag and drop to work properly, you have to like if you're doing like an ACF repeater, right, and you want to drag it, it's like, I've had clients before that they're like, I can't get this to move, right? And I'm like, yeah, I know what you got to do. You got to hold on it, and you got to go to the top of the screen while the viewport scrolls up. And then once that scrolls up, then you can go up to the and drag and drop it, where, there's always like these little hacky things with drag and drop.
Yeah. And in Gutenberg, like getting things to go into the right block. If you're like, oh, I need to move this out of this container block and into that one.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
At the time I end up having to use the, Navigator, what it's called, on the left, like where it list views all of them, and dragging it there, because I have such a hard time getting it to go into the container. Go above the container or below the container.
Or you put it in the wrong container. Because it's like there's a container around this block, right? Like, it's
the thing about the bank, though, is like, I can just imagine that whatever designer or developer thought of that, they were like, this is cute. This is fun, right? And it's like, it gives people a movement. But like, they thought they were, I bet they were so excited about it, right? And unique. But
no,
I'm just
bet,
like,
I bet it's legitimate.
Your money should be not unique or special, right?
It's probably a legitimate test, like not robot test, like CAPTCHA, alternative to a CAPTCHA.
Yeah, I think what Steve's saying is it would be hard to spoof, right? Or for like false transfers or someone's account getting hacked, or.
But I mean, is that logged in, right, Steve? Don't they have all the multi-factor doing it?
Yeah.
Yeah. A script. Yeah.
But don't they have all the multi-factor for getting logged in?
Yeah, but with the new like security stuff that's happening around like session spoofing, that's like the new frontier in hacking. It's like, you can capture someone's browser session and it has all their cookies in there, and you can be in Czechoslovakia and log into their bank and do a bunch of stuff with scripts. So yeah. I think that might be it, Steve.
It's a security feature?
I bet you it is.
I mean, only if all the people who can't use mice.
that's what we're talking about, right? It keeps out robots and it keeps out people with disabilities, which is a bad thing.
Yeah. So obviously this was a much needed addition to the web content accessibility guidelines, because this one, unlike the stuff we were talking about with Focus, where I was like, wasn't this covered already? Like, this seems very unique. I don't remember anything else specifically referencing dragging movements. And I mean, that is a...
These marbles keep bouncing around.
But I think like that, this is a sign of the advancing internet, right? Like, we're thinking of new technologies, and like when WCAG was first created, you couldn't really drag and drop stuff probably as much as you can now. So.
Yep.
So what's next?
Target size.
All right.
You want to take that one, Steve? Did Steve read the last one? I'm all topsy turvy. All right.
I know he's had too much carbonated
sugar.
Right, I'll take this one. So the size of the target for pointer based inputs is at least 24 by 24 CSS pixels. 24 by 24, that seems big. That seems bigger than I expected, except where undersized targets are positioned so that if that pixel diameter circle is centered on the bounding box of each, the circles don't intersect target the other circle or another undersized target, or they're equivalent, the function can be achieved through a different control mechanism, or inline, the target is in a sentence or its size is otherwise constrained by the line height of the non-text target. So there's a bunch of exceptions to this, but the target for a pointer input is 24 by 24 pixels.
Did we say this is a double A requirement?
Yes.
We didn't. Okay. So this is double A.
Yep.
24 by 24 is not very big. Like, you couldn't put cancel inside, you couldn't make a button that says,
I guess,
cancel.
I'm thinking like points and fonts, which is not the same as pixels, right? Yeah. So like I was thinking
this is like a tiny little square, 24 by 24.
Okay. Yeah.
Go ahead, Steve.
I mean, 24 high is kind of skinny, like a skinny button, right? Like, we try to make our buttons around 40, 50 pixels high. But...
And what was, there's already a AAA guideline that existed that I think it needs to be 46 pixels square as a minimum.
On triple?
AAA. That was in 2.1. I thought I remembered there was a tap target size on there. But of course now I can't find it. And I was like at the last moment thinking I should, let's see. Oh no, it's 44. Okay. So yeah. So this one already existed in 2.1, which is, success criterion 2.5.5 target sized enhanced AAA. And that requires a minimum of 44 by 44. And so they decided that we need to add a AA equivalent to this rule and look for the minimum 24 by 24. And really, this is like, it's not just for, I mean, sometimes it's helpful for mouse pointers, like we were talking about people that have more jittery movements or something like that. But also on touchscreen devices, so like phones, if you have large fingers, or there are people who don't have fingers and they might be using like a mouth stick that they hold in their mouth in order to tap, or they might be using like their elbow, like a larger surface area. And so having larger tap target size can be really helpful.
So are they saying that this doesn't require to inline?
So they're saying one of the exceptions was if it's a link in a sentence a link in a sentence, you don't have to make the spacing between the links, rows of text 24 pixels, right? So, but it's more like floating buttons. So things like your social media links in your footer, or a submit button on a form that's on its own line, things like that. And really, I feel like when you think about what was really small, it probably was like social media links or buttons in nav menus or in the footer, or social sharing icons. Like anything with an icon, sometimes I see designers will make those really small.
Yeah, like where you're utilizing an ARIA label rather than actually outputting the text on the, I mean that leads, okay. I'm looking at our website, at our social icons, but ours look fairly large.
How big are they if you look at them?
Let me look. Inspecting. They're 44 by 44.
Oh yeah, because
Because the
triple
triple A. Way to go,
A.
Amber. I'm sure you that was
I
you.
know. That was totally me. I mean, they're in the footer. They're probably made with a widget. I probably put it in there and set the size. I think we use Simple Social Icons plugin for social media icons in the widget areas, which does like it has appropriate labels and hides the icon and everything, which is good. So does not require a developer to make things accessible, which is always nice.
That's right.
So the next one I'll take, this falls under our guideline of predictability. So meaning that things will operate the way we expect them to. And so this is a single A, which means really bare minimum. And it's 3.2.6 is the number that it was given, consistent help. And basically, what this says is if a web page contains any of the following mechanisms, so things like human contact details, or a way to contact a person, or a self-help option, or a fully automated contact mechanism, and they're repeated on multiple web pages within a set of web pages, they occur in the same order relative to other page content unless the change is initiated by a user. So basically, if you have help in your nav menu, no matter what page they're looking on, it should be in the same order in the nav menu. If you have one of those chat bubbles, which I mean, we could have a whole conversation about that, and maybe that actually would be a really fun podcast episode in the future. But if it's the last element in the DOM and it's in the bottom right corner, it's always in the bottom right corner. It doesn't like on some pages go to the left corner or something like that. That's how I understand this. I don't know if you guys understand it differently.
No, I think that makes sense.
No, just be predictable and consistent with how you lay things out across your entire website.
Yeah, can you think of an example where that is not followed a lot?
Oh, where the help information moves around.
Or something moves. Is in different like places on different pages. I mean, sometime like we try to like archive like from archive to archive, like from post type to post type, we try to have a consistent feel across those. But I can.
Yeah, I mean, this one is specifically referencing any like a way to get help, right? Or support.
Oh, okay. So it's not just anything. Okay, I see.
Yeah, and it's not anything. It's just anything referencing like how to get help or support or contact. I mean, I could potentially see that where I don't know if I've seen it myself, but I could see maybe designers were like, on the home page, we're going to put our live chat in the bottom right, but on this other page, we need something else there, so we're going to put it on the left, right? Or we're going to put it at on the side, sticky on this one side.
I don't know if this would exactly apply, but I feel like I've had experiences like this going in and trying to cancel certain SaaS products or plugin license plans where it's like they make it hard. They don't make it easy or straightforward, which
So
I know
like,
is not exactly this, but it's the same kind of thing where like I can see like someone particularly with like a cognitive disability, a person with that, I don't know how they would deal with that.
I don't know if it's related, but like
If I can barely get through it, at times.
I don't know if this relates to this, but or if this is just a tangent, but like if the page accidentally refreshes and then I'm out of live chat, I hate that.
Yeah, so that is one thing that's nice. I've been on some websites like WP Engine is pretty good this way. When you're in their portal, if you need help, you can be chatting with them. And if you open another tab, your chat is still there in the new tab and it still works. And you can go back and forth between the different tabs and still talk to them. Or if you forget to open, click a link and open it in a new tab and it goes to the page, it still loads it and you don't lose. Whereas I've been on other hosts where the second you click a new tab, it like totally ends your chat session. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, this might fall under that potentially with predictable and support, right?
Yeah, because if you're in support and they're saying go to your dashboard and check this, right? And if you go there and then you no longer have your chat, that's not very predictable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that would be the double A or triple A.
Mm-hmm. So now we're moving from predictability to helping people with inputs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this first one, which Steve, I'll let you take, but I feel like this one is going to be a gotcha for a lot of school registration forms and government websites with long and complex forms. You want to take us away?
Yeah. This is 3.3.7 redundant entry, which is a single A. Information previously entered by or provided to the user that is required to be entered again in the same process is either auto-populated or available for the user to select, except when re-entering the information is essential. There's a link to essential. I won't click on that now, but I'm sure that helps us determine what essential
means.
The information is required to ensure the security of the content, or previously entered information is no longer valid.
So this is an interesting one that I've wondered if it will end up impacting WordPress core. So here's a good example of this. If I go to forget my password, I have to type either my username or email address in order to get it to send me the password reset link. And then I click the link to log in again. I think based on this, which is a single A guideline, my username or email address should be pre-filled in the username or address field because I've already provided it to the website one time and I am in the same session with the same cookie or whatever, right?
Yeah, but so, you're not in the same session. You're in a new session.
I'm in the same tab and I just click the link that says go back to log in and I go back. That's how I interpret this.
It's going to send you a link, right? In your email, and you're going to click on that link, which opens a new.
Okay, yeah. Well, in that one, it'd be even easier because they could put your email. With that, you would open the thing and you would get a form to reset your password. It wouldn't ask you for your email address. You would reset your password. You hit submit, it saves it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a link that's like log in, right? And then you click that and it loads you in. And I feel like it should not ask you to retype your email address and your username because it's already... Now, the password is a security thing, right?
Yeah.
So that's the exception. We're not going to not ask you for your password to log in at that point. But I feel like the username or email address should probably be pre-filled because it knows you're trying to log in as that user based on the workflow that you just went through.
Yeah.
And this is really important for people who can't use traditional keyboards that are maybe typing with eye tracking or a sip and puff device, and they're like blowing in certain ways. It can take a long time to type things out. And so having that, I think, is why this would be helpful, is to reduce asking people for things.
Yeah.
Your pain point, Chris, I think, was we have 4 children, and every year when you register to them for school, you have to like type in our address and our phone numbers and all the emergency contact information every single time for
times in the same session. So this is a violation now. It shouldn't happen.
I know. You can complain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like
it's a school. I mean, and it's a government. Our kids are going to a charter school, but it is publicly funded with public dollars.
We're just
gonna
sue everybody after this episode. But what you described, Amber, that's a complicated fix, right?
Is it, do you think?
I think, given WordPress is on half the internet, you know, that probably has
but
to
I mean
be...
that's just a change in core, isn't it? I mean, obviously, yeah. If you have a front-end login form, then they're all the plugin developers who manage those have to do that. But what about like just changing it in core?
Yeah,
would that be that hard?
I don't know that the actual code to change it would be that hard, but the process in which to get that deployed into a WordPress release might be hard. But like what Chris is describing, and what we as developers do a lot, there's a lot we can do that's fairly simple. Like if we're using Gravity Forms, right, we can auto-populate another field based on a previously filled out form. And so there's simple steps that we can take as developers to achieve this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Assuming that the form plugin you use supports, like Gravity Forms does, and a lot of the premium plugins do support like auto-filling fields and stuff. But if you're using Contact Form 7, probably you're going to fail this single A guideline. So the next one is a AA 3.3.8 accessible authentication minimum. So this is a minimum level for that. And it says a cognitive function test, such as remembering a password or solving a puzzle, is not required for any step in an authentication process unless that step provides at least one of the following. So either A, an alternative, so you could have a different authentication method instead of solving the puzzle, or a mechanism to assist the user in completing the cognitive function test, or if it is to recognize objects. So this gets around all the CAPTCHAs that tell you to pick all the stoplights or buses or whatever. That apparently is a exception. Or the cognitive function test is to identify non-text content the user has provided to the website. So like, what was your first pet's name or something like that, that you previously provided. Mm. So that's okay. But you know what I think fails this? Doesn't Jetpack add the what's 3 plus 7? Like, it adds math problems to the login. So I think that this is one that I'm thinking of that Jetpack is going to have to correct. Or websites that need to be accessible cannot turn that feature on in Jetpack. No math problems.
Even as simple as a math, because it doesn't give any like level to the right? Like, there's no like criteria on what level of cognition is required.
Yeah, so even 1 plus 1.
Just real quick, can you explain to us why it labels these minimum?
So usually when something is labeled as minimum, that means that there's going to be two versions. So there'll be a AA and that's the minimum. And then the same thing will be a AAA. So that's the interesting thing is some of the guidelines, the color contrast is one. There's a AA, which is the minimum color contrast you want to have. And then there's enhanced, which is a AAA, which is a higher level of contrast between colors. So you could be AA compliant, but not AAA compliant. Or if you are AAA compliant, then you also are automatically AA compliant because it's the same success criterion subject area or something.
I guess it indicates that there's not a single A version.
There isn't single A. It's just, they're like on a scale, the two things. So they did also add a AAA version. I don't know if somebody wants to say what the difference on the AAA is.
I was going to say the marked difference there, and that's the enhanced version of the same rule, is you can't have the object recognition or personal content alternatives in the AAA. So you couldn't have like those CAPTCHAs that make you pick out all the bikes or the cars or the traffic lights or whatever else. Something to identify non-text content.
So dragging a dollar sign across the screen, is that a violation?
Is that a cognition test? I don't know. That I feel like that's more of a mobility test, but maybe it's a cognition test if there's no clear instructions telling you what to do. Like, how would you know that to submit the form you have to drag this item to that? I don't know. I still think that's really weird and I want to see it.
Screen capture that and put it up on Twitter.
Yeah, assuming it doesn't that have all my bank account numbers.
Yeah, yeah. Make sure our bank. Yeah, make sure our bank. Is this your personal bank or our business?
Our business bank. Which one is it?
They're both at the same bank, but different accounts. So it's both.
It's both, yeah. See, so the company and we can complain.
I'm going to say that again, more slowly. Same bank, different accounts. Don't go out there and say that all the Equalized Digital's funds are running through Chris's personal bank account. Not happening.
No. So basically, those were the new things that were added in. I'm sort of curious. We've talked a little bit about this, what we think might be implications for WordPress as we've been going. But what do you guys take on whether organizations should start working on these 2.2 and including them versus continuing to say our organization meets 2.1 or even 2.0, which is technically what all is required for Section 508 compliance. What do you guys think? Should organizations be doing this? They've been out since October.
I don't like, so 2.0 is the minimum requirement, right? By most government and university, right?
Well, for in the US, Section 508, right? Yeah. But I know in Ontario, they say 2.1.
It's coming. Yeah. There's no harm in preparing yourself and getting caught up or being ahead of the upgrade or the guidelines, right?
Yeah, and I think out of all of these, the one that I feel like might be the hardest is that, well, there's two things that might be the hardest, but the first one is not asking people for redundant information. Mm-hmm. That one out of all of the, I mean, some of the other ones are CSS. So I'm like, meh, whatever. That's not hard to be like, we're just going to do this. But that one seems like it could be more complicated depending upon what kind of information you're asking. Yeah,
if you're an organization that uses a lot of web forms for things, that could be challenging. I feel like with this stuff, it's, we'll see slow ramp up with adoption. I mean, Amber, with our audits, we're always advising on the latest standards. We give people everything, right? And then they can decide how far they want to take it. Like if they want to leave off AAA as a phase two or what have you.
Have you had any clients or prospective clients, Chris, tell you that they want to meet 2.2 or are they even aware that 2.2 exists?
Everything I've seen recently is still referencing 2.1. AA or AAA. I never see 2.0 typically in anything. So most people are still in 2.1 land. I haven't seen any 2.2. I did like as a way to impress them and differentiate us. I did in a recent RFP response reference 2.2. And even in the Q&A portion of the RFP say, hey, this new version is out. Your organization seems to really care about this stuff because it's a regional like service placement organization that helps individuals with disabilities get access to services, job placement, et cetera. And so I said, 2.2 is the most recent version. Your RFP says this. Do you actually want this or do you want, to go all the way, 2.2 AAA? And I sent them like the summary and some other stuff and they ended up saying, yeah, we want the latest and greatest. So if I land us that project, we will have a project coming up really soon where we're going to be building something that meets these new standards, which will be fun. And they have a lot of web forms. So that'll be something interesting. And maybe we'll eventually be able to have a case study or something to share as like how we tackled that criteria, right? On this new version of this website.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to ask them. I'm going to say when we get it instead of if, but when we get it, if we were the only agency that referenced 2.2.
We were. I already know because I have someone on the inside. Sales tip, guys, have someone on the inside before you respond to the RFP. This person's calling me weekly, giving me updates without me having to ask. And the most recent update was I'm not going to name the organization, so I don't think I'm, revealing anything sensitive here, but there were on this RFP, there were six responses. Three of the six recommended overlays to this organization.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Bummer. It's probably because they don't actually know how
to
do accessibility.
And they're like, nope. So right there, 50% of our competition got eliminated. By the way, for the agencies listening, this is like a $90,000 website project. So if you want to compete for these, you need to not recommend overlays. You're going to get laughed out of the room.
I mean, that could be a whole episode in and of itself. But like, if you're recommending an overlay, you're basically telling them you don't know what you're doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like,
this is like red flag giganto.
Run
for
out.
Any,
so
maybe
our,
not for a small business website, because that person probably doesn't know, but for like an agency, like an entity that is government funded or that supports people with disabilities, like they're gonna
higher
know.
Ed, yeah,
higher
healthcare,
ed.
A lot of the industries that actually have money to fund large website projects, which are the types of projects that most agencies interested in growth want. Yeah, don't recommend an overlay or you'll be self-selecting out. So 50% of our competition is out right there. The other two of the three did not reference the current standards or really speak significantly to their testing process, according to my internal context. So maybe we can say when. I don't know when we get it. But
knock on wood.
I think
he knocked
that,
on his head, by the way,
yeah,
for anyone.
Yeah. For our listening audience,
knock on glass. We can knock on the marble.
Oh, maybe if you can get your marble to make noise.
anyway, that kind of turned into a tangent, but I think we're going to see slow adoption over time. For our part, Amber, right. We're going to test up to whatever the current standard is and people can decide with our help what makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm curious, do you feel like we can write rules for any of these in Accessibility Checker, Steve?
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, I think we can definitely evaluate forms for redundant information. We could check.
That is, I'm sorry to interrupt. That is not the one I thought you were going to say. That's impressive.
Really? I mean, we can check for, the size of buttons, the hit area and stuff.
That one's easy.
That was the one that I was thinking.
Maybe. It's somewhat easy.
I feel like it gets harder when it's like
CSS.
How do you differentiate between links in a paragraph or body text versus links that are by themselves to know that, oh, these ones are excluded?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit that goes into that, right?
Because you could only do it on links that have a role of button.
I mean, you would
not a role of button, sorry, a class of button or something. Like you could look for certain classes and be like, oh, okay, they're intending this to be a button. And so therefore we're going to, or to look like a button.
I mean, you could traverse outside of the links and check and see if it's inside of a paragraph tag. I mean, that's probably the most simple. That's the most basic.
In.
Yeah. Cause buttons typically are not going to be inside of a paragraph tag.
Yeah.
So I'm curious now because I wasn't expecting you to say double entry, the redundant entry one could be tested for. What do you think at a high level you would do without giving away too much?
On the spot in 2 seconds, how would you figure that out?
How would you code this? I would.
He's the CTO for a reason, guys.
Goodness. I would grab all the forms.
Mm-hmm.
And then go through, then parse through each form and evaluate for similar labels.
Okay. So if like label strings matched a certain amount, you give a warning.
And here's Amber. She's going to blow that out of the water. What do you got?
No. What I was going to say was, I think like extending off of this is if you can tell if a user is logged in, you should probably never ask them for their name on a form.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that is literally a user meta field, right? It should just be there. They can edit it.
Yeah, yeah.
But like their name, their email address, if you're asking for social media, like any of the core user meta fields that already exist, you should probably always pre-populate those on any form if someone is logged in. And then if you've added your own user meta or you're using a plugin, like a membership plugin or something that adds user meta, same thing. Like your form should go know to look for that.
Yeah.
And populate it in. forms like Gravity Forms, which is what I have the most experience with. It has merch tags that are like super easy.
Yeah, yeah.
To just like get, like, it doesn't even require code to do that. I mean, that's where I would start, but I don't know how you would tell. I mean, maybe you could tell if a form was on a restricted page and only logged in users could access it or something. And then you'd be like, oh, this is one where theoretically that should have pre-populated info. I don't know.
Yeah, we have the benefit of being inside of WordPress, right? So, yeah, we could check for you know, user fields as well. It wouldn't be an exact failure. Like, I think it'd be a warning.
Yeah, because our definition of warning is we think this might be a problem, but you should check it.
Yeah, it requires some manual evaluation. But yeah, we do have a form on our plugin on the welcome page, on our main plugin page, that has a form to subscribe to our email newsletter. And it does pre-populate with your email and your username.
Whoever is logged in.
Yeah.
We'll see that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. Thanks for letting us put you on the spot with those, Steve.
No problem.
Well, you know, as we wrap up here, I realized the thing that we didn't say about I think this is funny because I call these pops, but this is a carbonated Ramune drink.
Drink. Mm-hmm.
But it also has Japanese writing all over it. So maybe that's a more literal translation than soda or pop.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you buy it again?
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah? Mm-hmm. I will. I told Amber and Chris this, but Chris sent me a 5-pack of these.
Yeah, something like that.
And the second they hit the door and I opened the box, the kids are just like, bother me. When are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? When
they wanted one? The extras.
They went the extra ones and like, and then like my daughter last week was, she just wouldn't stop. She kept picking it up and bringing it to me. She's like, we got to do this. And I was like, fine, we can do one. But the kids love these things. They taste good too.
I like that it's not as sweet. Like that grape soda one we had, I was like, oh my God, I feel like I'm drinking liquid sugar. This is not as bad.
So. Yeah, they're $1 a piece on Amazon. You can get them, listening audience. Mm-hmm. And they'll if you have Amazon Prime, they'll be there within a day or two. So mm-hmm. make the kids happy. Give them a drink and an activity all in one.
There you go.
Okay, I will say though, I actually find drinking out of the top of this thing hard.
Yeah.
Like I haven't finished mine, and it's because I feel like I have to take time because it's got a really wide plastic rim.
Yeah.
And then there's like a small hole in the middle, and I can't, like, I think I want a straw. So that would be my recommendation. I don't feel like they're super drinking friendly.
I kind of feel like I'm making a mess of it a little bit, you know, when
but they are neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
All right, y'all. Well, thank you for being here today. And to our listeners, we will see you next time.
All righty. See you guys.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Accessibility Craft. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in your podcast app to get notified when future episodes release. You can find Accessibility Craft on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And if building accessibility awareness is important to you, please consider rating Accessibility Craft 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Accessibility Craft is produced by Equalize Digital and hosted by Amber Hines, Chris Hines, and Steve Jones. Steve Jones composed our theme music. Learn how we help make thousands of WordPress websites more accessible at equalizedigital.com.